From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Cindy Sain, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent, and Nancy Marshall Genzer, Senior Reporter for Marketplace. Welcome, Nancy and Cindy.
Hello. Thank you.
Well, here are the issues. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi faces daunting days ahead as she races to unite feuding factions within the Democratic Party and pass a massive social benefits package at the heart of President Biden's agenda, along with a separate infrastructure bill, all before November. In less than 3 weeks, voters head to the polls in Virginia to decide between former Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe and GOP nominee Glenn Youngkin, who are in a close race in the state. McAuliffe said in a recent interview that the leaders of both the Democratic and Republican parties in Washington need to get their act together. The group of 20 major economies is determined to tackle the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. Leaders met in an emergency virtual summit hosted by Italy. The United States is considering the full range of tools at its disposal, including the use of economic sanctions to respond to the worsening crisis in northern Ethiopia. Tigray forces say Ethiopia's government has launched a major military offensive against them to end a nearly year-old war. Russia was not invited to attend a virtual summit hosted by the White House on countering ransomware attacks. As supply chain bottlenecks around the world threaten to dampen the U.S. holiday shopping season, President Biden unveiled a plan to ease West Coast delays at the ports of Long Beach, California, and Los Angeles by expanding round-the-clock operations. Central to the plan are commitments by some of the nation's leading retailers and shippers to ramp up overnight and off-hours operations at the shipping ports. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Cindy, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is attempting to thread a delicate needle, weighing the demands of energized liberals against those of cautious moderates who are sounding alarms about deficit spending, government overreach, and the harm the debate might do to their 2022 reelection prospects. So how is she going to close this divide?
Yes, you're right, Kim. Threading the needle or walking a tightrope, you know, these are the images that people are using to describe the difficult position that she is in. And she is a veteran at getting votes and knowing exactly when to hold the votes, but she really is facing a tough challenge in her own Democratic Party between centrists and progressives on President Biden's signature Build Back Better agenda. $3.5 trillion. And as regular listeners of your program will probably know, the Democrats hold the slimmest of majorities in the Senate. And there are two centrist Democratic senators, Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, some would say obstructionist senators at this point, who just say they can't vote for the $3.5 trillion. And what we are hearing is that it's going to be trimmed by at least $1 trillion. And Pelosi is now saying Democrats, instead of cutting a little bit off of each thing, may eliminate entire pieces of this social safety net and climate change bill, which would expand child care and paid leave and Medicare for struggling Americans. Progressives, though, are just coming up with a new idea and saying instead of eliminating these really good, what they see as really good programs, cut the overall cost by shortening the time frame. This is a 10-year bill, which I think gets lost sometimes in the sort of the way that it's Democrats have maybe not been doing the best job of selling it either. And progressives are saying shorten the time, that shortens the overall price tag. But there again, will the two centrist senators go for that? Not sure.
Also, Nancy, the House Speaker this week acknowledged the challenges that they face as they trim the cost, as Cindy was pointing out, of this $3.5 trillion social benefits package in ways that can satisfy both sides of the party. So what's your take on this in the short amount of time they have?
It is such a tall order. And as Cindy was saying, the Democrats really haven't done a very good job of selling the benefits to the American people in this legislation. And it's funny because if you were to poll people on the various aspects of this bill, like expanding Medicare, which is the health insurance program for seniors in the U.S., to include covering dental care and vision care and hearing care. People support that. They support universal pre-K. They support free community college. But a lot of Americans don't know what's in this bill. They just know how much it would cost. And another hurdle for Speaker Pelosi is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has launched what it calls a significant six-figure paid advertising campaign in opposition to the bigger $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. They say they support the bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure bill that passed the Senate, but they do not support the larger bill, and they're targeting moderate Democrats in swing districts around the country.
So they have just a short amount of time to get all of this work done, so we'll continue to cover that. And moving on now to our next topic, McAuliffe is in a close race with Republican Glenn Youngkin in the U.S. state of Virginia. The Virginia governor race is seen as a test of Democrats' strength before the 2022 midterms and 2024 presidential election. So, Nancy, how are the challenges on Capitol Hill affecting this race?
You know, it's so interesting because this race is really driven by national issues, not local issues, and also by two people who aren't even in the race, former President Trump and the current President Joe Biden. A lot of the independent voters who are leaning toward the Republican Youngkin say they just really don't like Joe Biden. McAuliffe is trying to tie Youngkin to former President Trump. He's raising issues like abortion. He says, if you have Youngkin as your governor, he'll try to restrict your abortion rights. Youngkin had reportedly said that he couldn't speak out on abortion the way he would like to because he didn't want to alienate suburban women. But he's trying to cozy up to Trump, but also not get too close because he doesn't want to alienate those swing voters, suburban women and independents.
Yes, and he did say, McAuliffe said, quote, I tell Democrats Donald Trump is desperate for a win here, meaning Virginia. And he said, if Glenn Youngkin wins, it's a win for Donald Trump and you're going to begin his political comeback. So really, Cindy, is this a big concern for the Democrats?
Well, I think it is a big concern. And certainly former President Barack Obama is going to Virginia to campaign for McAuliffe, and President Biden is going back, and they're sort of sending in all their star players, the First Lady, and Republicans are pointing to this, that they're worried and they're desperate. The recent polls that I've seen do show McAuliffe leading, but with a slimmer than comfortable, maybe like by 4 or 5 points. And Virginia in recent years, you know, we say here in the U.S., is a blue state, more Democratic leaning, where red leaning is Republican, and some say it's actually a purple state. You have Northern Virginia, which is close to Washington, D.C., which is where most of the population is, which leans definitely Democratic. So this will be an interesting race. And then, as Nancy pointed out, that basically it's sometimes like a proxy race. You know, President Biden is going to campaign. I've not heard that former President Trump has been asked to campaign for Youngkin. So I think he's also walking a bit of a tightrope himself there.
How did this race come to get to be so close?
I think part of it is some of these independent voters just disapprove of the job President Biden is doing. It may have to do with all the confusion in Washington, with just barely avoiding the U.S. defaulting on its debt, not being able to get this infrastructure package through. Also, Youngkin has an advantage on his ideas to reduce violent crime. That's a big theme of his campaign. And there's this issue of, you know, masks in schools and the whole issue of mandating vaccines for employees. Some of these independents who are leaning toward Youngkin don't like that at all.
Well, on to a virtual emergency summit with G20 leaders concerned over the growing economic and humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan since the Taliban took over the country last month. The country, already struggling with drought and severe poverty following decades of war, has seen its economy all but collapse and causing a humanitarian crisis and an exodus of refugees. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi said after hosting the summit that G20 countries will coordinate efforts with the Taliban to address this crisis. So, Cindy, are they confident the Taliban will work with them?
Well, no, and I think you've hit right on the key point there. This emergency summit, President Biden did attend, the Indian Prime Minister Modi, a number of European leaders conspicuously absent were the Chinese president and the Russian president. And the European Union has pledged $1.1 billion to help the humanitarian crisis. The U.S. was a bit more cautious. And I think for the U.S., it's the core question is how to help the Afghan people who are really facing economic collapse and, you know, no food, no medicine, without supporting the Taliban, which is, of course, is now in charge. And this is a very, very difficult situation. You know, all the countries that were attending agreed in principle, you know, that something has to be done and that, you know, they want to help the Afghan people. But how to go about it? Before the meeting, for example, China is demanding that the U.S. and Britain, where most of the assets are being held, you know, unfreeze the assets for the Afghan government that the Taliban could then access. But the U.S. and Britain are not doing that because they say the Taliban is not respecting the rights of women and girls and is going back to its, you know, to the way it ruled the country before. So it's a very, very difficult situation.
As you pointed out, President Biden, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and many European leaders took part. And as you said, China and Russia did not dial in, suggesting differing international positions on this emergency. So, Nancy, what is Russia and China's view on Afghanistan?
Well, they seem to have a lower bar on preconditions that they would set for things like diplomatic recognition and when to resume aid. You know, back to Cindy's point about, you know, comparing how much the EU pledged, $1.15 billion versus what the US has pledged, $64 million in aid for Afghanistan. There's a big gap there. You know, the US has frozen $10 billion of reserves, Afghanistan's reserves held in New York, and the Afghan central bank has almost no money in its vaults. So, you know, Afghans have been lining up at banks trying to get their money out and they can't. So really the European Union is worried about a humanitarian disaster and they have their self-interest at heart here as well. They don't want a huge wave of refugees crossing the border and ending up in their countries, you know, that they would be responsible for.
Yes, and another big issue is Secretary of State Antony Blinken held high-level meetings on Ethiopia, including with officials from the African Union, Sudan, the UK, France, Germany, and the European Union. They are urging parties to immediately end abuses and enter negotiations towards a ceasefire. So is this enough urging from outside of Ethiopia for the warring parties to listen?
Let's hope so. I've seen reports that some Tigrayans are eating leaves to survive, and the Ethiopian prime minister has been accused of trying to starve the Tigrayans out. You know, the burden, so much of the burden of this war is falling on civilians. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the U.S. has provided almost $663 million in humanitarian assistance for northern Ethiopia since this all started. But, you know, the U.S. is estimating 6 to 7 million people in northern Ethiopia are in need, and 900,000 of them are facing famine. So really, this is all hitting the civilians the hardest.
Absolutely. And Cindy, Washington has repeatedly called for a negotiated end to the conflict in the northern region of Tigray between federal forces and those aligned with the TPLF. So should the U.S. be doing more?
Well, it's just hard to know exactly what they can do. They have been preparing things. President Biden issued an executive order saying that they can sanction Ethiopian officials. They are openly discussing perhaps an airlift to get humanitarian aid because Prime Minister Abiy has been basically blocking humanitarian aid from getting to the Tigray region. So it is a very, very difficult situation. Blinken is trying to kick diplomacy into high gear, as you said, meeting with the African Union representative, trying to get, you know, African leaders to work on this. President Biden and Blinken are meeting with the Kenyan president. Kenya also shares a border with Ethiopia. So this is a terrible problem. And Abiy has expelled UN workers. And this war has been going on for almost a year now. And human rights groups have accused almost every side of atrocities, including using rape as a weapon. But most human rights groups point mainly to the Ethiopian forces and Eritrean forces for the worst of the abuses.
Yes, a very concerning situation there. Time now for a short break, and when we come back, a virtual summit hosted by the White House on countering ransomware attacks, focused on disruption, virtual currency, and diplomacy. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists who are joining me via Skype, Cindy Sain, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent, and Nancy Marshall-Genzer, Senior Reporter for Marketplace. Well, Nancy, earlier this year, two high-profile ransomware attacks forced the temporary shutdowns of the largest oil pipeline in the U.S. and the largest meat processing company in the country, with Americans feeling the effects of these shutdowns. And in July of this year, President Biden signed an executive order to help further protect the U.S. infrastructure from cyber attacks. So how does he intend on fighting these ransomware attacks?
Well, so this week, President Biden held a meeting with 30 different partners, a lot of them from the private sector, talking about ransomware, which the Biden administration says ransomware payments reached over $400 million around the world in 2020. So they're really asking the private sector to step up, but they're also going to help. The Department of Justice has established a task force. The Treasury Department is, for the first time, levying sanctions against a virtual currency exchange, because the Treasury Department says that exchange, you know, helped facilitate some ransomware payments. So basically, the Biden administration is telling the private sector, we will help you, but you need to step up.
Cindy, it's no surprise that Russia was not invited to this discussion. However, Biden administration officials reportedly intend to engage with Russia on the issue through a set of expert consultations, which began after President Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva earlier this year. So how will the White House go about engaging Russia on this issue?
Right, Kim. Notable from by their absence were, again, Russia and China from this meeting. And, you know, it's known that a number of criminal hackers live and work in Russia and China. And as you cited, those two most high-profile attacks of the major fuel pipeline and the meat supplier were linked to groups in Russia. And the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said, this is a meeting of 30 countries, and he said, like-minded nations. And the U.S. does not consider Russia a like-minded nation. And Sullivan is saying these countries realize how serious the ransomware threat is. And so, yes, senior administration officials sort of off the record are saying that we're dealing with Russia and, you know, back channels, expert consultations, saying these talks are very direct and very candid, but they're basically waiting for Moscow to follow up. And of course, Russian President Putin denies that the government has anything to do with this, but some experts say, well, they must at least be tolerating or in some ways harboring these criminal groups. And some experts say this is getting beyond criminal. This is a real threat to critical infrastructure.
Also, and just giving a little bit of really background on a ransomware attack, this is when the hacker holds the victim's data hostage, threatening to either permanently delete it or release it publicly unless they agree to pay a ransom, often in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. So, Nancy, just to clarify, what is Bitcoin, and is Bitcoin here to stay?
It is here to stay. Bitcoin is a virtual currency. And the thing about it is it fluctuates all over the place because it's not tied to any nation's currency. So there's another type of virtual currency. It's called a stable coin. And they are tied to, say, the US dollar, and they only fluctuate within a certain range of the dollar. But Bitcoin is pretty unstable, and it fluctuates quite a bit. It's also pretty secret. It's hard to trace, and that's why cyber criminals want to be paid in virtual currency.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. And also, the U.S. supply chain was another big issue in the news this week. President Biden unveiled a plan to try to ease West Coast delays at the ports of Long Beach, California, and Los Angeles by expanding round-the-clock operations. Together, these ports account for approximately 40% of the shipping containers entering the U.S. So how are these delays at the ports affecting consumers?
Especially leading up to the holidays, this is a big deal. The pipeline for getting imported products into the U.S. is just really slowing down. And some retailers are warning that, you know, there could be fewer choices for consumers when they go to shop for the holidays, that prices could be higher. And what President Biden got the ports to agree to do, the ports in Los Angeles and Long Beach, is to basically work 24/7, work at night. Also, some companies like FedEx have agreed to work with the ports more at night and ship things more at night, so there'd be less traffic, so trucks could get through quicker. I'm just not sure how big of an effect this will have, because there are so many issues affecting supply chain, like COVID, like a shortage of workers. So this is a step in the right direction, but I don't think it's going to solve the problem.
Right. As Nancy said, Kim, and just sort of anecdotally, my sister said that she went to buy some shoes and the clerk told her, look, if you think you might want these shoes, or, you know, you get them, because I can tell you that there's no merchandise coming. So, you know, people are starting to hear if they want things or if they want to start buying Christmas gifts, they better get them now. And as Nancy said, there are just thousands of shipping containers on cargo ships offshore waiting to be offloaded. And it's Los Angeles and it's Long Beach, but it's also New York and Savannah. And then it's complicated by a shortage of truck drivers and warehouse workers. So it is a serious issue, I think, being felt in many places, not only in the U.S.
Yes, absolutely. The White House even warns of other global supply bottlenecks choking ports, highways, and railways. And as you all pointed out, this could cause Americans to face higher prices. And as we all have seen, some empty shelves. So I know that there seems to be just many factors causing all this, but is there any one root cause that started this domino effect? Could it have been COVID?
Yes, because a lot of the chips, the semiconductor computer chips, are made in Taiwan. And, you know, you had factories shut down because people got sick. One other thing that we haven't mentioned is there's actually a shortage of containers to move the things. And Cindy, you briefly mentioned rail. I am a big rail fan. I'm a kind of a geek. And I follow an organization called the Association of American Railroads. It's a trade group for the freight rail industry in the U.S., and it keeps track of rail volume. And it said that intermodal volume, now intermodal, those are the trains that carry the containers that traveled on the ships. They're lifted right off the ships and plunked down onto the train. So intermodal train volume was down 7% last week versus the same week in 2020. And 2020 was not a great year because of the pandemic. So last week was down 7% from the same time in 2020.
Yes, this is all very concerning. And thanks for sharing all of this great information. And I guess that the bottom line with this is that if you really want or need something, and you can, just go ahead and get it now.
But, you know, there's an economic problem that comes with that, which is if you get this panic buying and hoarding of things like toilet paper, that pushes prices up.
The political side of this for President Biden, who has already taken a hit with the chaotic departure from Afghanistan, and then, you know, he wants to be a transformative president with his social safety net, and Democrats are having trouble with that. So if people can't buy toys for their children for Christmas, it's going to hurt him.
Yes, and we're going to have to end the show on that note. My thanks to our panelists, Cindy Sain, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent, and Nancy Marshall-Genzer, Senior Reporter for Marketplace. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.